The Renewing Cell. Stem Cells and the Birth of Transplantation. He not busy being born is busy dying. Bob Dylan. You are busy being born the whole first long ascent of life, and then after some apex, you are busy dying. That's the logic of the line. Rachel Kushner, The Hard Crowd. Stem cells don't simply transform themselves into other cells, a process called differentiation, to build what the body needs and then, their work done, quietly disappear. They are more than the progenitors of other cells. They also replicate themselves in an unrefined, undifferentiated state so that they can stick around to answer the call later when the blood system needs rebuilding. Joe Sornberger, Dreams and Due Diligence. On August 6, 1945, at about 8:15 in the morning, 31,000 feet above the Japanese city of Hiroshima, an atomic bomb nicknamed Little Boy was dropped from an American military aircraft, a B-29 bomber nicknamed the Enola Gay. The bomb took about 45 seconds to descend and then detonated in midair, 1,900 feet above the Shima Surgical Hospital, where nurses and doctors were at work and patients still in their beds. It released about the energetic equivalent of 15 kilotons of TNT, about 35,000 car bombs going off at once. A circle of fire, more than 4 miles in radius, spread out from the epicenter, destroying everything in its wake. The tar on the streets boiled. Glass flowed like liquid. Houses were flicked into oblivion, as if by a giant incinerating hand. Outside the stone steps of Sumitomo Bank, a man or woman who was vaporized instantly left a shadow of herself on the stone that had been blistered white by the conflagration. The waves of death that followed had three crests. About 70,000 to 80,000 people, nearly 30% of the city's population, were broiled to death almost instantly. I was trying to describe the mushroom cloud, this turbulent mass, one of the tail gunners of the aircraft wrote. I saw fires springing up in different places, like flames shooting up on a bed of coals. It looked like lava or molasses covering the whole city, and it seemed to flow outward into the foothills where the little valleys would come into the plain, with fires starting up all over. Then came a second wave from radiation sickness, or atomic bomb sickness, as it was initially called. As the psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton noted, survivors began to notice in themselves a strange form of illness. It consisted of nausea, vomiting, and loss of appetite, diarrhea with amounts of blood in the stools, fever and weakness, purple spots on various parts of the body from bleeding into the skin, inflammation and ulceration of the mouth, throat, and gums. But there was yet a third wave of devastation to come. Survivors who received the lowest doses of radiation began to develop bone marrow failure, resulting in chronic anemias. Their white cell counts sputtered, then declined and collapsed over a few months. As the scientists Irving Weissman and Judith Shizuru put it, those who died from the lowest lethal dose of irradiation almost certainly died of hematopoietic blood production failure. It wasn't the acute death of blood cells that killed these survivors. It was the inability to sustain the constant replenishment of blood, a collapse of homeostasis of blood. The balance between regeneration and death had been tipped. To paraphrase Bob Dylan, the cells not busy being born were busy dying. Macabre as it was, the bombing of Hiroshima provided proof that the human body possesses cells that continuously generate blood, not just in the moment, but for prolonged periods of time through adulthood. If these cells are killed, as they were in Hiroshima, the entire blood system would eventually falter, unable to balance the rate of natural decay with the rate of rejuvenation. In time, these cells capable of rejuvenating blood would be termed blood-forming or hematopoietic, stem and progenitor cells. Our understanding of stem cells was born of a paradox, an unfathomably violent attack in an attempt to restore peace at the end of an unfathomably violent war. But stem cells are themselves a biological paradox. Their two principal functions seem, at face value, to be precisely opposed to each other. On one hand, a stem cell must generate functional, differentiated cells. A blood stem cell, for instance, must divide to give rise to the cells that form the mature elements of blood. White cells, red cells, platelets. But on the other hand, it must also divide to replenish itself. For example, a stem cell. If a stem cell achieved only the former function, differentiation into mature functional cells, the reservoir of replenishment would eventually be exhausted. Over the course of adulthood, our blood counts would keep falling year after year until there were none left. In contrast, if it only achieved its own replenishment, a phenomenon termed self-renewal, there would be no production of blood. It is the acrobatic balance between self-preservation and selflessness, self-renewal and differentiation, that makes the stem cell indispensable for an organism, and thereby enables the homeostasis of tissues such as blood. Cynthia Ozick, the essayist, once wrote that the ancients believed that the moist track of slime left behind by a snail in its trail was part of the snail's self. Bit by bit, as the slime rubs off, the snail is depleted until the organism disappears altogether. A stem cell, or in the snail's case, a slime-producing cell, is a mechanism to ensure that the moist track of slime, for example, new cells, are generated constantly, and that the snail does not rub itself into oblivion. Allow a peculiar analogy. It's tempting to think of the stem cell as an ancestral great-great-great-grandfather or grandmother. Its progeny give rise to more progeny, resulting in a vast lineage that arises from a single great-great-great-grandfather cell. But to be a true stem cell, this must be the oddest of great-great-great-grandfathers. It must also give birth to a copy of itself that can maintain the replenishment of the lineage. This great-great-great-grandfather, besides birthing a child that will go on to establish an enormous lineage, must also birth a copy of itself, an eternally alive twin. And once this self-renewing great-great-great-grandfather is born, the process of regeneration can become limitless. There's a mythic quality to such a setup, and indeed, in myths, one often finds attempts by powerful kings or gods to make backup twins. Dolls, voodoo objects, souls secretly stored in animals, twin personhoods locked in amulets. To reboot themselves and their clan should something terrible happen. Like most real stem cells, these mythic doubles usually lie dormant, quiescent, until an injury wakes them up. And then they awake and reseed the whole clan. It results not in birth, but rebirth. Do all adult organisms have stem cells? Do such cells exist in every tissue or in just some? In science, as in fashion, trends are intensely in vogue for a moment and then discarded the next. In 1868, the German embryologist Ernst Haeckel had proposed that all multicellular organisms arose out of a single cell, the first cell. By logical extension, that first cell must have the properties of differentiating into every cell type, blood, muscle, guts, neurons. It was Haeckel who used the term Stammzellen, stem cell, to describe this first cell. But Haeckel's use of the term stem cell was still loose. The first cell certainly generated a whole organism, but did it generate a copy of itself? For a while in the 1890s, biologists debated whether such a totipotent cell, one capable of giving rise to every tissue in the body, might be hidden away somewhere in the adult organism. In a sense, females possess a precursor of such a cell, the egg. Once fertilized, it can give rise to all the tissues of a new organism, although, sadly, it doesn't regenerate the mother. In 1892, the zoologist Valentin Hacker, studying the Cyclops, a multicellular freshwater flea, named after the Greek monster because its body resembles a single eye, found a cell within it that divided into two. One daughter cell gave rise to layers of tissue that formed part of the organism, while the other became a germ cell, a cell capable in the future of giving rise to all the tissues of the organism, and thus a stem cell. Hacker also termed these cells Stammzellen, borrowing the term from Haeckel. But unlike Haeckel, Hacker's use of the term was more precise. Here was a first cell that divided to give rise to one daughter that gave rise to the body of the Cyclops, and another cell, Hacker proposed, that could generate a new Cyclops all over again. But mammals? Of all organs and tissues found in mammalian organisms, the one place to look for such cells might be blood. Red blood cells, and some white blood cells, neutrophils for instance, are constantly dying and being replenished. If a stem cell were to exist, where else would it be but in blood? The cytologist Arthur Pappenheim, studying the bone marrow in the late 1890s, had found islands of cells where multiple cellular types of blood were being regenerated, as if a single central cell was capable of generating multiple cell types. In 1896, the biologist Edmund Wilson used the phrase stem cell to describe a cell capable of differentiation and self-renewal, just as Hacker had observed in Cyclops. As the idea of a stem cell gathered popularity in biology in the early 1900s, it became more hierarchically defined. A totipotent cell could give rise to all types of cells, including every tissue in the organism, including the placenta, the umbilical cord, and the structures that nourish and protect the embryo. Lower down in the rung of renewal was a pluripotent cell, a cell capable of giving rise to nearly all cell types in the organism. For example, all tissues in the fetus, brain, bones, guts, except the ones that form the placenta and the supportive structures that link the fetus to the mother. And even lower still in the hierarchy was a multipotent cell, a cell capable of giving rise to all cell types in a particular kind of tissue, such as blood or bone. Between the 1890s and the early 1950s, some biologists argued that the various elements of blood, white cells, red cells, and platelets, all emerged out of the same multipotent stem cells resident in the bone marrow. Others suggested that each cell type emerged from a unique stem cell. But without formal proof in either direction, interest in this mystical blood stem cell fell out of vogue. By the 1950s, references to stem cells had largely vanished from the biological literature. In the mid-1950s, two Canadian researchers, Ernest McCullough and James Till, launched a collaboration to understand the physiology of blood cell regeneration after radiation exposure. An unlikely duo, Till and McCullough came from very different backgrounds. McCullough, stout, short, hefty, was the scion of an old-money Toronto family, as one biographer described it. He had a lively, wandering intellect. He thought tangentially, often playing connect the dots. McCullough trained in internal medicine at the Toronto General Hospital. He was recruited briefly as the head of hematology at the Ontario Cancer Institute in 1957, but found himself bored with the humdrum practice of medicine and soon left to become a full-time researcher. Till, in contrast, was a tall, skinny farmhand from Saskatchewan with a PhD from Yale in biophysics. He had an arrow-like mind, was mathematically inclined, and relentless about details. To McCullough's inventive madness, he brought method. There was complementarity, too, in their interests and expertise. Till had trained in radiation physics. He knew how to calibrate radiation and measure its effects on the body. He had been a student of the notoriously exacting Harold Johns, who had worked on the effects of cobalt radiation. McCullough was a hematologist with an interest in blood and its genesis. In 1957, when they had launched their collaboration, Toronto was a sleepy regional town. Scientific news trickled in. But in the aftermath of the bomb, there had been an international stir to study whether bodies and organs could be protected from the lethal effects of irradiation. Till and McCullough were particularly interested in the effect of radiation on blood. But how might they quantify that effect? When they exposed a mouse to a large dose of radiation, they found that the genesis of blood would stop in about 2.5 weeks, and the mouse would die, akin to the victims of the third wave of death in Hiroshima. The only way to rescue the mouse was to transfer marrow cells from another mouse into it. By transferring cells from another mouse's bone marrow, the organ where blood is generated, Till and McCullough could rescue the irradiated mouse, and the animal would resume its genesis of blood. It was this crude assay, the rescue of a near-dead animal, that would open a new frontier in stem cell biology. On a wintry Sunday afternoon in December 1960, a few days before Christmas, Till left his house in Toronto to look at the results of an experiment in his lab. The experimental setup was simple. Mice had been irradiated with doses high enough to kill their intrinsic genesis of blood and transplanted with marrow from other mice. Each mouse had received a different number of marrow cells, a titrated dose, to rescue it from death. Till sacrificed the mice and prepped them for autopsies, looking methodically through each organ: marrow, liver, blood, spleen. Superficially, there was not much to see, but when Till looked carefully at the spleen, he found tiny white bumps, colonies. Mathematically minded, he counted the total number of colonies in each mouse and plotted them on a graph. The bumps lined up nearly exactly with the number of transplanted marrow cells. The more cells they transplanted, the more colonies were formed. What could that mean? The simplest answer was that these colonies were not just a random count of transplanted cells that happened to have encountered the spleen, but rather a quantitative measure of a special kind of cell. This cell had to possess the intrinsic property to form colonies in the spleen, a sign of regeneration, and it had to exist in a fixed ratio in the bone marrow. Hence, the more cells that were transplanted, the more bump-like colonies were produced. Till and McCullough would soon discover that each bump, a colony, was a regenerating nodule of blood cells. But not any regenerating nodule. These colonies were making all the active elements of blood, red cells, white cells, and platelets, and they were extraordinarily rare, about one colony for every 10,000 cells from the marrow. Till and McCullough published their data in a paper with a prosaic title, "A Direct Measure of the Radiation Sensitivity of Normal Mouse Bone Marrow Cells," in an academic journal of radiobiology. Note that there was not even a passing mention of stem cells. "You have to remember that it was a fairly small group that was interested in this kind of work at that point," Till wrote. "This was way before all the excitement about what has happened over the next decade or so, but instinctively, Till and McCullough knew that their result had revealed a principle of enormous significance. A tiny fraction of transplanted marrow cells, like intrepid founders crossing an ocean on a makeshift boat, had migrated to the spleen and set up isolated colonies to regenerate blood, all the major cellular elements of blood. As Joe Sornberger, the science writer, described it, the paper represented an entirely new way of looking at how the body makes blood, not to mention presenting a raft of potential implications for other biological rethinks, as in, if that's true for blood, then how does the body make heart muscle or brain tissue? But it did not immediately knock the scientific world off its axis and went largely unnoticed by the larger biological community. Working with Lou Siminovich and Andrew Becker in the early 1960s, Till and McCullough deepened their studies on these colony-forming blood cells. First, they established that some colonies were producing all three kinds of cells: red cells, white cells, and platelets, the definition of a multipotent cell. A year later, they proved that each colony had arisen from a single founder cell. And finally, when they isolated the colonies of cells from the spleen and transplanted them into radiated mice, they found that they could recapitulate their capacity to generate additional multipotent colonies, the hallmark of self-renewal. They had, in effect, discovered a cell capable of giving rise to not just one, but multiple lineages of blood cells: red cells, white cells, and platelets, the blood-forming, or hematopoietic, stem cell. Irving Weissman, now the director of Stanford's stem cell program, was a student when he read Till and McCullough's first paper on radiation sensitivity. "The real discovery," he said later, "was to turn things around from the bone marrow is a black box, we don't know anything about it, to the bone marrow has discrete cells that can make multiple different cell types." Weissman remembers how the experiment ricocheted through the world of cell biology. Till and McCullough had reset how people think of blood, the vital source of life. Until the Till and McCullough experiments, people thought that every distinct cell type in blood came from a unique parental cell, he continued. But Till and McCullough proved just the opposite. The red cell mother and the white cell mother and platelet mother cell, Weissman told me, all arose from the same stem cell, and these stem cells kept giving rise to more and more cells, red, white platelets, until an entirely new blood system had been created. The effect on the field of bone marrow transplantation was extraordinary. If transplanters could find this cell, they could regenerate the entire blood system. They could build a human with new blood out of that stem cell. And so Weissman went looking for that cell. Where did these stem or progenitor cells reside? What was their behavior, their metabolism, their size, shape, color? Inspired by the Till and McCullough experiments, Weissman began to use a technique developed at Stanford by the wife and husband team of Lenore and Len Herzenberg, called flow cytometry, to purify the cells. Simplified to its essence, flow cytometry is like coloring cells with crayons, each cell at different permutations of color. One, blue and green, another, green and red, based on the permutations of proteins on their surface. The crayons are antibodies, carrying chemicals that fluoresce in different colors that recognize the different proteins on the surface of a cell. A machine can be used to separate cells based on their staining by different permutations of colors. Weissman went through dozens of permutations and finally found one combination of markers that could purify mouse blood stem cells taken from bone marrow. As Till and McCullough had predicted, they were rare, with a frequency of fewer than 1 in 10,000 cells, but exquisitely potent. Eventually, as Weissman's technique was refined and more markers were added, researchers could isolate a single blood stem cell and regenerate the entire blood system of a mouse. And they could extract a single such cell out of that mouse and regenerate the blood of a second mouse. In the early 1990s, Weissman and other researchers used the same technique to identify human blood-forming stem cells. Mouse and human hematopoietic stem cells are similar looking. They are small, round cells with compact nuclei. In their resting state, they largely remain dormant. For example, they rarely divide. But put into the right milieu of chemical factors, or given the right internal signals in the bone marrow, they begin a ferocious program of cell division. In the 1960s, the Australian researcher Donald Metcalfe was among the first to find these chemical factors that enable the growth of particular kinds of cells that emerge from the stem cell. A single stem cell can produce billions of mature red and white cells, and an entire organ system of an animal. In the spring of 1960, a 6-year-old girl named Nancy Lowry fell ill. She was dark-eyed and dark-haired, with eyebrow-skimming bangs. Her blood counts began to fall. Her pediatricians noted that she was anemic. A biopsy of her bone marrow revealed that she had a condition called aplastic anemia, a form of bone marrow failure. Yet Barbara Lowry, Nancy's identical twin, was perfectly fine. Barbara's counts were normal, with no evidence of bone marrow failure. The marrow produces blood cells, which need regular replenishing, and Nancy's was rapidly shutting down. The origins of this illness are often mysterious, an infection or an immune reaction or even a reaction to a drug, but in its typical form, the spaces where young blood cells are supposed to be formed gradually fill up with globules of white fat. The Lowrys lived in leafy, rain-slicked Tacoma, Washington. At Seattle's University of Washington Hospital, where Nancy was being treated, the doctors had no clue what to do next. They tried transfusing her with red blood cells, but the counts would inevitably collapse again. One of them knew of a physician-scientist named E. Donald Don Thomas, who had tried to transplant marrow between humans. Thomas worked in Cooperstown, New York. The Seattle doctors contacted him for help. In the 1950s, Thomas had attempted a new kind of therapy in which he infused a leukemia patient with marrow cells from the patient's healthy identical twin. There was fleeting evidence that the blood stem cells from the donated marrow cells had engrafted into the patient's bones, but the patient had swiftly relapsed. Thomas had tried to refine the blood stem cell transplant protocol on dogs with some marginal success. Now the Seattle doctors persuaded him to try again in humans. Nancy's marrow was faltering, but no malignant cells were occupying it. The Lowrys, fortuitously, were identical twins with perfect histocompatibility, bone marrow could be transferred from one to the other without rejection. Would the blood stem cells from one twin's marrow take in the other twin? Thomas flew to Seattle. On August 12, 1960, Barbara was sedated, and her hips and legs were punctured 50 times with a large bore needle to extract the crimson sludge of her bone marrow. The marrow, diluted in saline, was then dripped into Nancy's bloodstream. The doctors waited. The cells homed their way into her bones and gradually started to produce normal blood. By the time she was discharged, her marrow had been almost completely reconstituted. Nancy's blood, in a sense, belonged to her twin. Nancy Lowry lived through one of medicine's first successful bone marrow transplants. It was the quintessential instance of cellular therapy brought to life. Her twin's cells, not a drug or a pill, had been Nancy's medicine. In Toronto, Till and McCullough were characterizing blood stem cells through their discoveries in mice. At Stanford, Weissman would eventually learn how to purify them from human bone marrow. In Seattle, Donald Thomas had brought these blood stem cells into medical use. He had enlivened them in humans. In 1963, Thomas moved to Seattle for good. Setting up his lab first at the Seattle Public Health Service Hospital and then, a dozen years later, at the newly established Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, the Hutch, as doctors called it, he was determined to use marrow transplantation in the treatment of other diseases, notably leukemia. Nancy and Barbara Lowry were identical twins, and a non-cancerous blood disease in one had been curable by cells from the other, a vanishingly rare occurrence. What if a disease involved malignant blood cells, as with leukemia? And what if the donor wasn't a twin? The promise of transplantation had been hindered by the fact that our immune systems are inclined to reject matter from other bodies as foreign. Only identical twins with perfectly matched tissues can sidestep the problem. Thomas saw a way around this. First, he would try to eradicate the malignant blood cells with doses of chemotherapy and radiation so high that the functioning marrow would be destroyed, purged of both cancerous and normal cells. That would usually be fatal, but the donor marrow stem cells from an identical twin would then replace it, generating healthy new cells. The next problems arose from trying an allogeneic transplant, allo from the Greek word for other, transplanting marrow from someone who wasn't an identical twin. In 1958, the French pioneer of bone marrow transplantation, Georges Mate, had transplanted bone marrow from a series of donors to some Yugoslavian researchers who had accidentally received toxic doses of radiation and had thereby developed fulminant bone marrow failure. The donor cells had engrafted briefly, but then eventually disappeared. But soon after transplantation, Mate had observed quite the opposite of what he had expected. An acute wasting disease appeared in the bodies of the Yugoslavian researchers. Mate deduced that this wasting disease was caused by immune response in the donor marrow attacking the body of the transplanted patients. The guest was attacking the host. This response is the consequence of an ancient system for maintaining the sovereignty of organisms and rejecting invading cells, except in bone marrow transplants, the direction of sovereignty is reversed. Like a mutinous crew forced onto an unfamiliar ship, the donor's immune cells recognize the body around them as foreign and attack it. The other, that is, previously the graft, becomes the self, and the self, ipso facto, becomes the other. Other pioneers in organ transplantation had learned that these forces of rejection could be blunted if the donor and the host were reasonably well matched. Recall our discussion of the discovery of histocompatibility genes. Genes that govern whether a recipient will accept a graft from a host. There were now tests to help predict compatibility, or tolerance, and to improve the chances that allogeneic marrow cells would engraft. And various immune-suppressing drugs had been developed to further dampen the host's resistance, thereby allowing the allograft, that is, from a foreign donor, to be accepted by the body, or the guest from attacking the host. Over the next few years, Thomas assembled a group of doctors who pushed the frontiers of bone marrow transplantation. There was a tall German-born rowing fanatic named Rainer Storb who focused on tissue typing and transplant therapy. His wife, Beverly Torek Storb, was an astute clinician. A diminutive Siberian-born soccer enthusiast named Dr. Alex Pfeffer had shown that immune systems could turn against tumors in mice, hence the donor's immune system could kill the leukemia. And Don's wife, Dottie Thomas, who ran the day-to-day affairs of the lab and the clinic, and whom everyone called the mother of bone marrow transplantation. Thomas, who won a Nobel Prize for these studies, later described them as early clinical successes. But for the nurses and the technicians in Seattle who cared for the patients, not to mention the patients themselves, the experience could be harrowing. Of the 100 patients with leukemia who were transplanted in those early years, 83 died within the first several months, one of the doctors told me. The final cataclysm in this biblical array of plagues happened when white blood cells produced by the donor's marrow mounted a vigorous immune response to the patient's body, the phenomenon called graft versus host disease that Matei had discovered in his early transplants. It was sometimes a passing storm and sometimes a chronic condition. In either acute or chronic form, the disease could be fatal. But as Fred Applebaum, part of the team of doctors who performed the first bone marrow transplants for leukemia, and other researchers found when they analyzed the data, the immune attack on the self, graft versus host, could also be an immune attack on the leukemia. Those that survived this cataclysm were also those that were most likely to beat the leukemia. It was the most definitive proof that a rebooted immune system from a foreign donor could engraft into a body and then reject a cancer, resulting in the cures of deadly variants of blood cancers. It was a stunning but sobering result. The poison was the cure. When I reminded Applebaum of those early transplants, I caught a wistful look in his eye, as if he was remembering each of the patients. He has a gentle patrician air about him, with a humility acquired from years of failure. He thought back to the years when no one had survived, and then to the years when, one by one, the team had witnessed long-term survivors of cell therapy for lethal diseases. They had succeeded, but at such a steep price. I met the Thomases, Don and Dottie, at a conference in Chicago. They had grown frail and thin and held on to each other like two playing cards propped against each other. Remove one, and the other would fall. I walked up, among a throng of admirers, to pay my regards to the twin parents of cellular therapy. Don ambled up to the podium to speak. Once famous for his looming stature, he stooped as he spoke, pausing between sentences. The convention hall was packed to its edges. Nearly 5,000 hematologists had gathered to hear the talk, and the air was thick with reverence. Don reminisced about the early days of transplantation and the heroic efforts, and the equal heroism of the first patients, that had ultimately led to the first allogeneic bone marrow transplants. In 2019, I flew to Seattle to interview the nurses who had worked in the bone marrow transplant ward during the first years of its inception. Most had retired, but some had stayed in touch with the hospital. I sat in a conference room a few floors above the glistening new labs where patient cells were being readied for gene therapy trials, such as the one that had resulted in Emily Whitehead's cure with CAR T cells. The nurses hugged and kissed each other as they came in. They remembered their nicknames and the names of all the patients who had been treated in those early years. Some of them broke down in tears. This was an impromptu reunion. I've deliberately concealed the names of the nurses. This is not to diminish their vast contributions to bone marrow transplantation, but to protect their identities and respect their privacy. "Tell me about the first patients," I asked. "The very first was a chronic leukemia patient," a nurse, A.L., told me. "His name was Bowlby, an elderly man," she said, and then corrected herself. No, he was just in his 50s. He died from an infection. Number two was a young man with leukemia, and then a little girl. Both of them died." They remembered Don and Dottie, the Storbs, Applebaum, and Pfeffer, the stalwarts and pioneers of early cell therapy. "Every morning, one of them would be at rounds, holding each patient's hand, asking how the night had been," one said. "In 1970, We had a young boy with leukemia, another nurse said. He was 10. He survived and went through college, about 10 years, but he struggled with lung infections. And then he died. I asked about what the hospital looked like, what it felt like. There were 20 beds, another nurse, J.M., said. The nurse's station was in the ice room. I remember it was small. It was close. Everyone was pulling for everyone. There was one child who wanted to hear the same story every night, about a boy who went into a cave and killed a bear. And so, night after night, while chemo dripped through his veins, he was sent to sleep with that story. The place where the patients were doused with radiation to kill their blood cells and make space for the new marrow was a cavernous cement bunker a few miles away. The dogs, used for transplant experiments, were housed next to it, so the patients, locked in the cement chamber, had to hear their incessant barking as they were being irradiated. Initially, the entire dose of marrow-killing radiation was given in one slug. Halfway through the radiation, the patients got so nauseous that it was unbearable, one of the nurses said. They vomited and vomited. We had to open the bunker doors and go in and tend to them. There weren't really any strong anti-nausea medicines then, so we went in with water, tubs, and mouth wipes and wet towels. And there was this 7-year-old boy. She choked up. Another woman stood up to hug her. Tell them about the pilot, one of the nurses urged. The pilot was Anatoly Grishenko. In 1986, when the nuclear reactor blew up in Chernobyl, Grishenko was sent on a helicopter to dump sand and concrete to entomb one of the open vents of the reactor that was spewing toxic radioactive gas, in essence to convert the factory into a cemented sarcophagus. He was supposedly covered head to toe with lead shielding, but the radioactivity penetrated his body, all the way to his bone marrow. In 1988, he was diagnosed with a pre-leukemic disease. In 1990, the disease bloomed into a full-blown leukemia. A woman in France was found to be a near-perfect match. A doctor from the Hutch flew to Paris to supervise the extraction of the bone marrow and jetted the marrow overnight to Seattle, where Grishenko underwent a bone marrow transplant. But he didn't make it, the nurse told me. We watched over him for days, but in the end, the leukemia came back. And so it went. We had one survivor from 1970, three from 71, and in 72, we had a few. We didn't have a lot of long-term survivors, but some of them did make it to 20, 30, 40 years. By the mid-80s, we began to really see long-term survivors. Tens, twenties, dozens of them, living 5 or 10 years after the transplant. Downstairs, in the lobby of the Hutch, there was a spiral sculpture that represented the seemingly relentless and steady progress of transplantation. I took a closer look, watching the numbers spiraling upwards year by year. 5, 20, 200, 1,000, up to several thousand by 2021, and the cure rates for deadly diseases had also increased. In one study, patients with acute myeloid leukemia had between a 20% and 50% chance of survival 5 years post-transplantation. One of the nurses had come down to look at the sculpture with me. She put her hands on my shoulders. It wasn't so easy back then, she said. The smooth spiral line, she knew, was in fact a jagged record of failures, punctuated with infrequent successes. But then, the successes accumulated. Thousands of bone marrow transplants are performed each year now for dozens of diseases. Their success varies, but it is now one of the mainstays of cellular therapy. In my own clinic, I can think of throngs of patients with deadly variants of leukemia that have been cured by bone marrow transplantation. The nurse ran her hands along the smooth line of the curve and smiled. I thought of Grishenko in his helicopter, suspended in midair and surrounded by a fog of toxic plutonium. Of the boy who went into a cave to kill a bear. I could sense the terrifying fear of the young child in the cement chamber, bent over with nausea, while the dogs barked next door. I thought of the nurses with wet towels, and of those who stayed overnight, those who kept vigil against infections, those who held the patient's hands all day and watched them as if they were their own children. As the nurses left the hospital, many of the doctors and the staff stood up as they passed. It was a silent recognition of their many, many contributions. I realized that I had tears in my eyes. cell therapy for blood diseases had a terrifying birth. Stem cells have been found in diverse organs and in diverse organisms. But more than any other type of stem cell, the two that remain the most fascinating and most controversial, perhaps, are the embryonic stem cell, ES cell, and its even stranger cousin, the induced pluripotent stem cell, iPS cell. In 1998, James Thompson, an embryologist working at the Wisconsin Regional Primate Research Center, procured 14 human embryos that had been discarded from IVF procedures. The experiment that he was about to perform, he knew, was inherently controversial, and he had consulted two bioethicists, R. Altacharo and Norman Foust, before even launching it. The human embryos were cultured in an incubator until they had reached the blastocyst stage, when the embryo forms a hollow ball. The blastocyst normally grows within the uterus, but it can also be cultured under special conditions in a petri dish. The ball has two distinct structures. There is a veil-like outer shell that will eventually form the placenta, and the structures that attach the embryo to the mother's body. Furled inside the shell is a tiny bulge of inner cells that will form the embryo. Thompson extracted these inner cells and cultured them on a feeder layer of mouse cells that would supply the human embryonic cells with nutrients and support. This is a common technique in cell culture. Some cells are so fragile, especially in the first days of their transition to cell culture, that they cannot live by themselves. They need feeder or helper cells to nurse them in these initial stages. Over the course of several days, five human cell lines grew out of the embryos, three males and two females. They proliferated for months in cell culture with no obvious genetic damage and with no change in their growth potential. Injected into immunocompromised mice, the cells made a gamut of layers of mature human tissue: gut, cartilage, bone, muscle, nerves, and elements of skin. The cells were clearly capable of self-renewal in a petri dish and capable of differentiating into multiple, possibly all, kinds of human tissue. A technical point: the ES cells derived by Thompson came from the inner cell mass that will eventually form the embryo and not from the outer wall of cells that forms the placenta, the umbilical cord, and other structures that are called extraembryonic. These ES cells are not totipotent, since the placenta, to take one example, is derived from the outer wall of cells and not the inner cell mass. More recent work has shown that under some culture conditions, a fraction of ES cells can remain totipotent, in other words, capable of giving rise to extraembryonic tissues. However, most investigators consider human ES cells pluripotent, not totipotent, since they give rise to all tissues except the extraembryonic tissues. They were termed human embryonic stem cells, or HES cells. One of these cells, called H9, a female with XX chromosomes, has become the standard ES cell. It has been grown in thousands of incubators and hundreds of labs around the planet and been subject to tens of thousands of experiments. I've grown H9 myself and watch the cells grow continuously. I've also watched them differentiate into various mature cell types, including bone and cartilage. Even today, the existence of this cell line astonishes me. I cannot look through a microscope at a flask containing these cells without a small shiver, something akin to a nervous wistfulness about the future. In principle, the existence of these ES cells prompts a strange thought experiment. What if one could turn time backward and inject them, a little curl, back into the cellular womb of the blastocyst from whence they came, and implant that ball back into a human womb? Perhaps we would need to mix them with some other cells of the inner cell mass, but would they now return to their origin, form a human? What would we name her, this new kind of cellular being? Helen 9? If a genetic change was introduced into H9 in the petri dish, would that human now potentially bear that change and pass it on to her children? And if the H9 cells in the human produced an egg and then an embryo, would we witness a new circle of life? From embryo to blastocyst to ES cell to human to embryo? Thompson's paper, published in Science in 1998, set off an immediate firestorm. Many scientists sided with Thompson, who believed the inherent value of human ES cells, these cells would enable us not just to understand human embryology more deeply, but would also become therapeutically invaluable tools. As Thompson wrote pointedly toward the end of his seminal paper, "Human ES cells should offer insights into developmental events that cannot be studied directly in the intact human embryo, but that have important consequences in clinical areas, including birth defects, infertility, and pregnancy loss. Human ES cells will be particularly valuable for the study of the development and function of tissues that differ between mice and humans. Screens based on the in vitro differentiation of human ES cells to specific lineages could identify gene targets for new drugs, genes that could be used for tissue regeneration therapies, and teratogenic or toxic compounds. Elucidating the mechanisms that control differentiation will facilitate the efficient, directed differentiation of ES cells to specific cell types. The standardized production of large, purified populations of human cells, such as cardiomyocytes and neurons, will provide a potentially limitless source of cells for drug discovery and transplantation therapies. Many diseases, such as Parkinson's disease and juvenile onset diabetes mellitus, result from the death or dysfunction of just one or a few cell types. But critics, mostly from the religious right, would have none of it. They argued that human embryos had been destroyed, defiled, during the production of these cells, and that embryos constituted humans, that these IVF-produced embryos were yet to acquire sentience, had no organs, were no more than a ball of undifferentiated cells that would otherwise have been discarded anyway, hardly placated them. It was their potential to form future humans that made them currently human, Thompson's critics argued. In 2001, President George W. Bush, pressured by opponents of ES cell research, passed a law restricting federal funding to research involving ES cells that had already been derived, such as H9. Any attempts to make new ES cells could not be federally supported. In Germany and Italy, too, research on human ES cells was highly restricted and, in some cases, banned. For about a decade, a select few human ES cell lines was all that researchers had to explore human embryology and tissue differentiation from embryonic stem cells. And then, in 2006 and 2007, the field underwent yet another radical twist. The question that had raged through the field in the early 2000s was this: was there something about stem cells that made them special? Why could a skin cell or a B cell, say, not awake one morning and decide to become an ES cell, squirming its way upriver, turning back time to its origin? The question sounds absurd at first glance. Until the 1990s, no embryologists that I knew had thought of embryology as a two-way street. Go forward and you get a human, with all his or her mature cells, nerves, blood, liver cells. Go backward and you take a mature cell, nerve, blood, liver, and turn it into an embryonic stem cell. It seemed like pure madness, one researcher told me. But there was one fact that kept the fantasy of the two-way street alive, at least for a small group of embryologists. The sequence of DNA in all the cells, such as the genome, is identical in nearly all our cells. It is the subset of genes that is turned on and off in a heart cell or a skin cell that determines its identity. What if we could change that pattern, turn stem cell genes on and off in a skin cell? Would the skin cell now turn into a stem cell capable of making not just skin, but bone, cartilage, heart, muscle, and brain cells? That is, every cell in the body? And what was stopping a skin cell from doing just that? In 2006, working in Kyoto, Japan, a stem cell researcher named Shinya Yamanaka took adult mouse tail tip fibroblasts, spindle-shaped, run-of-the-mill cells that are found in various forms throughout the body, stuffing as far as the stem cell world goes, and introduced four genes into these cells. Yamanaka hadn't stumbled on these genes by accident. He had spent years studying and selecting OCT3/4, SOX2, CMYC, and KLF4 for their unique ability to reprogram the properties of adult cells to resemble stem cells. In the late 1990s, he had started with 24 genes, comparing the effect of each gene and each permutation, experiment after experiment, combining one with the next and then adding another until he had narrowed the relevant genes down to the critical four. Each of these genes encodes a master regulatory protein, a molecular switch that flicks dozens of other genes on and off. Each of them, he had established, plays a critical role in maintaining the stem cell state of human and mouse ES cells. What might happen if he took an adult non-stem cell, a humdrum fibroblast, and forcibly induced it to express all four of these master regulatory genes that give stem cells their identity, in combination? One afternoon, Kazutoshi Takahashi, a postdoc in Yamanaka's laboratory, looked down the scope at fibroblasts in which he had forcibly expressed the four critical genes. "We have colonies," the postdoc shouted. Yamanaka rushed over. Colonies indeed. The cells, normally spindle-shaped and prosaic-looking, had changed their morphology, turning into glowing ball-shaped clusters. Chemical changes had appeared in their DNA, Yamanaka would later find out. The proteins that fold and package DNA into chromosomes changed. Even the metabolism of the cells had altered. The fibroblasts had turned into stem cells. As with ES cells, they renewed themselves in culture and injected into immunocompromised mice. They too formed multiple kinds of human tissue: bone, cartilage, skin, neurons. All of this derived from a skin fibroblast, a cell that is fully developed and has no seeming function except to act as scaffolding to maintain the integrity of skin tissue or to repair a wound. The result was an utter shock to biologists, a Loma Prieta that shook the earth plates of the stem cell world. I remember a senior chemical biologist from my department returning from a seminar in Toronto where Yamanaka had just presented his data, visibly ruffled, breathless with disbelief. "I just cannot believe it," he told me after he'd returned from the talk. "But the result has been reproduced over and over again. It's got to be true." Yamanaka had made a stem cell out of a fibroblast, a transition thought to be impossible in biology. It was as if, presto, he had turned biological time backward. He had changed a fully grown adult not just into a baby, but into an embryo. In 2007, Yamanaka used this technique to turn human skin fibroblasts into ES-like cells. The next year, Thompson, of human ES fame, substituted two other genes for CMYC and KLF4, and again altered human fibroblasts into embryonic stem cells. The expression of CMYC in particular to create ES-like cells was considered a potential challenge because it happens to be a cancer-causing gene, and biologists worried that these ES-like cells would eventually turn cancerous. The field termed these induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells, induced because they had been changed, using genetic manipulations, from mature fibroblasts into induced pluripotent cells. Since Yamanaka's discovery, for which he won the Nobel Prize in 2012, hundreds of labs have started working on iPS cells. The allure is this: you take your own cell, a skin fibroblast or a cell from your blood, and you make it crawl backward in time and transform it into an iPS cell. And from that iPS cell, you can now make any cell you'd like: cartilage, neurons, T cells, pancreatic beta cells, and they'd still be your own. There would be no problem with histocompatibility, no immune suppression, no reason to worry about the guest turning immunologically against the host. And in principle, you could repeat the process infinitely. iPS into beta cell, back to iPS cell, into beta cell. To be fair, no one has tried this yet. The recursiveness, though, sets up yet another fantasy of a new human, one in whom every degenerated organ or tissue could be regenerated and regenerated again, ad infinitum. I sometimes think of the Greek story of the Delphic boat. The boat is built of many planks. Bit by bit, the planks decay and are replaced by new ones until all of them are new. But has the boat changed? Is it even the same boat? These musings seem metaphysical today, but they may soon become physical. And as we build new parts of humans out of iPS cells, and many scientists already have, and then try to make new parts out of those new parts recursively, I also think of Ozick's snail. Saved from rubbing itself into oblivion, it leaves a trail of metaphysical questions behind as it moves into uncertain, unknown realms. By the end, all of it has been rubbed off and replaced. Is it even the same snail?